Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that was having a relaxing holiday until it checked Twitter. My name's Corey Hazelest and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, in this episode, we're going to cover the good, the bad and the ugly of silly season and then try and discover what the state of British politics is just before MPs return to Westminster. This silly season, Steve, felt like a sillier silly season than usual.
It was full of repeats. That was the worst bit.
The fact that Traingate came back up and women-only train carriages came back up, which were the two silliest stories from the previous two silly seasons.
Yeah, I have to say I'm very disappointed with Corbyn's leadership on this. Like, they're just going back to the old hits now. They're not even putting out new material. It's just rehashes and repeats.
Maybe the problem is that we haven't had an annual Labour leadership election. In which Owen Smith, Bantasaurus Rex, our old friend, can joke about the size of his penis and fighting off thousands of Welsh men for his wife. And so therefore there's been a news vacuum which has been filled by people like Chris Williamson.
Yeah, that's definitely been the case, certainly on the Labour front. Chris Williamson appeared to have increased his media profile somewhat over the past few months. I mean, partially that's as a result of him basically standing as a true blue Corbynite and openly doing it and saying, I will live or die as an elected politician on the Corbynite sword. He was re-elected. Overall, Labour did very, very well. And I think he's seeing that as vindication, understandably so, but is trying to leverage that position into some meaningful boosts to his profile.
Indeed, I think, and we should not probably spend too long talking about Chris Williamson. Shall we, however, go on to the silliest of the silly season stories? In fact, I reckon maybe the silliest silly season story in decades, maybe ever. And it is, of course, Donald Trump's... No.
There's a whole other podcast on that.
Which, thankfully, we're never going to record. We can't get drunk enough for that. No, it's, of course, the Big Ben story.
Oh, God, yeah.
The MPs really concerned about that, or I think the Bellends, as I think they like to call themselves. Do you want to try and explain this story for anyone who's not been listening?
Essentially, Big Ben is broken. It needs repairs. It is an old bell. Every now and again, it does shut up, stop ringing, so that people can actually repair it. Because, you know, as they say, elfin safety gone mad. It's not gone mad at all. It's quite sensible. Means that you can't be working and repairing it whilst it's in danger of ringing out every 15 minutes because it is loud. You know, you can hear it across London.
So if you were a few feet away from the bell,
you would deafen yourself, even quite possibly with protection. So it is not a nice situation to find yourself working in. And as such, in order to repair the bell in order properly, it is going to be silenced. It's not going to ring for a couple of years.
4 years, Steve.
Four whole years.
That's more time than Donald Trump will be US president.
We hope. But yeah, so it's going to be quiet for 4 years. This has apparently angered and aggravated a number of different individuals, including Theresa May, who thinks it's shocking that Big Ben should be silenced.
And our old friend Peter Bowen as well.
Peter Bowen.
The Chris Williamson of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, Peter Bowen is, of course, angered by this because, he's Peter Bowen. Essentially, there have been demands that the way it's repaired changes so that the repairs happen at night. Essentially, people are getting their heads in a tizzy over the fact a bell in a clock isn't going to ring out because it's being repaired. That is the long and short of it. There's all kinds of patriotic language and symbolism and things like that, and hearkening back to the fact that, oh, the Luftwaffe didn't even stop Big Ben ringing. It did. They shut Big Ben up whilst the Blitz was going on.
They shut it up. I didn't know Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the Luftwaffe.
So there's just an awful lot of idiocy and language that's just completely over the top being used around this issue. Primarily because it seems to be there's a lot of middle-aged male politicians who are kind of using it seemingly as some kind of, I don't know, replacement for something they might be lacking. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm sure the phallic nature of the clock tower plays into it somewhere.
Absolutely. I don't want to go on to a discussion about Peter Bone's phallic nature.
Oh, could be
right, where are we going to go with this?
I mean, I was going to say, let's put a few kind of decent shout-outs to some of the MPs who have been very sensible on this. So a shout-out to Jess Phillips, MP, for basically, I think, echoing our thoughts exactly when she said, "It's a bloody clock, no one cares."
Hmm. A ringing endorsement, one could say, of the position. Also, Connor Burns, who was...
This was magnificent, yeah.
Yeah, so he said the politicians concerned about Big Ben did not have careers ahead of them, which is probably true. Stephen Pound, the Labour MP, who was out there, there were a group of them, weren't they? Heads bowed as the bonged its final bong. And he shed tears, actual tears were being shed, in what I imagine was an equivalent... In the school I work at this year, we changed our method of administration. We brought in a new administration software. A lot of tears were shed then as well, and the confusion of people trying to use the new software. This is what it feels like the equivalent of, is people getting really annoyed that the photocopier in the office has changed and not quite sure how to work the details. No one cares. Especially when there are bigger fish to fry. No MPs went down to Grenfell Tower and
had a visual, really.
Yeah. To quote Robbie Collin, it's like the time he taught himself to make gnocchi when he had a 4,000-word article on the Coen brothers' Jew. It feels like a massive procrastination.
Yeah, I mean, especially coming from members of the government. I mean, obviously, we've just talked about Connor Burns there, who does not fall under this classification at all. But there are members of the government, including Theresa May, who came out and made very public statements about how terrible this all was. And it's like... You should be negotiating Brexit. You should be dealing with the fact that we've got thousands of towers which seemingly were covered in flammable cladding. There are a myriad of things that the government should be getting on with. And yet Theresa May finds time not to talk on those issues during the recess, but to come out and talk about a bloody bell.
Well, indeed, especially when... The Luftwaffe, of course, didn't silence Big Ben, even though it did. But you know who did silence Big Ben? Margaret Thatcher. Because in the 80s, Big Ben was shut off between 1983 and 1985. I assume that Big Ben was shut off in 1983 because Big Ben was so devastated by Labour's loss in 1983. Actually, the longest suicide note in history was probably the thing that tipped Big Ben over the edge. Again, it's something that Stephen Bush echoed. So what Theresa May said is that it can't be right for Big Ben to be silent for 4 years. Well... It is. That's how long the experts say it will take. But
yeah, but we don't believe experts anymore.
That's true.
We've had enough of these so-called experts telling us how long our clock repairs will take.
I'm sure in the next cabinet meeting, Michael Gove will say, "I've got a brilliant idea of how we can solve what could possibly go wrong." In fact, I believe Michael Gove believes it's the blob and the deep state which is making sure that Big Ben can't go off. But the fact that May is pandering to the insane Tories who... almost certainly are right-wing Eurosceptic nutters. Just as she's pandering to them on Brexit by trying to give under-liberal terms, she's saying mad, silly things to try and appease them on this issue as well.
I don't know if this is just appeasement. I think Theresa May actually believe this. This fits in with an awful lot of kind of the patriotism, quote-unquote, angle that she's gone with previously, and I think she believes it, which is terrifying, but...
We'll have to see. The government, in the silly season, chose the perfect time to publish some Brexit papers, embargoing them till midnight and then publishing them after briefing them to the right-wing press beforehand.
Sounds about right.
I'm sure Brexit is something we'll talk a lot on in the next season of Not Enough Champagne. Something that has come out, in fact, just this week, the student visa issue.
Yes.
And the fact that, I mean, we both like evidence-based policy. We have a whole season lined up, listeners. For the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to fill your ears with evidence-based policy.
So we apologise in advance.
So in order to have evidence-based policy, you need, what's it called? Evidence. That's what we need. We have assumed, or the Home Office has said, that there are 100,000 students.
I would just like to make one addendum to that. It's the Home Office under Theresa May assumed
that there are 100,000 foreign students staying here after graduation. These terrible foreign students coming over here, having qualifications,
contributing to our economy.
Setting up businesses, employing our women. So 100,000 of them. It turns out the actual figure is 4,600 stay, and the other 95,500 go. And to be out by a magnitude of 95.6% sounds impressive, listeners, but it's probably also about the accuracy of our general election predictions. So we can't really gloat too much.
Yeah, but the difference is we weren't, nobody was actually utilising our general election predictions to set government policy in any form.
I certainly hope not. Can you imagine? Maybe that explains the mess. Now, this is terrible for a number of reasons, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, these numbers were being utilised as justification by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary to clamp down on various immigration areas. Turns out also apparently that they knew this number wasn't 100% accurate.
Or even 10% accurate.
Yeah. So there's some serious questions that Theresa May has to answer on this, because if she was knowingly utilising bad data to justify it, that's a lie. That is outright lying to the British public about the state of immigration in the UK. And given that immigration is such a hotly contested area and plays such a massive role in the EU referendum as well, she needs to be able to say that she didn't know that it was happening, or find somebody to sacrifice under the bus and throw them under it.
Maybe she could sacrifice Nick Tim. No, he's gone.
I mean, Fiona. No, she's gone. No. Michael Gove.
Again,
yeah.
Maybe. Probably George Osborne's fault.
Also, everything's George Osborne's fault. Yeah, essentially, Theresa May has got some serious questions to answer on this. And if she isn't able to actually provide some reasonable responses to those questions, then a half-competent opposition, and I say that knowing that we have a Corbyn as leader of the opposition, which may or may not be a good thing.
Everything's forgiven now, Steve. That's the line.
Yes, this is true. We are all Corbynites now. But
apart from those damn centrists.
I know. So basically, a half-decent opposition is going to be able to make hay with this and kind of attack the government and attack the Prime Minister very effectively, if it turns out that she didn't, that she actually knew about these figures, and it will massively undermine her authority. She is now already kind of suffering in terms of her personal ratings. It turning out that she's actually lied to the British public could be one of those random things which could snowball into her losing her prime ministership. It's not saying that's going to happen, but you can see a path where it could.
I mean, the one thing I would add is, to say that this could massively undermine Theresa May's authority. Her authority's already massively undermined. This is just kind of digging a pit below the pit.
You say that, though, but she's still Prime Minister. At the end of the day, whilst the Tories are still willing to put up with her, she will remain that. And I think it's, but things like this are going to be what pushes some people over the edge in terms of stopping talking about getting rid of her and actually start trying to.
I see the difference there. Yeah. Especially because she was one of the longest serving Home Secretaries, I think, of modern times. Yeah. She was there for six years, I think.
Which is impressive. The Home Office is where people go to end their political careers normally. You don't normally go to the Home Office and then end up as Prime Minister.
No. Turns out the thing that would have ended Theresa May's political career just came out when she was Prime Minister.
Yeah.
So that's fun. So, is it possible to be friends with a Tory?
Yes.
Okay.
I know this because I am. As are you.
Why is it necessary for me to ask that question?
Because a certain, and I use this phrase loosely, but as it's been used to describe her, an up-and-coming Labour MP by the name of Laura Pidcock, well, gave an interview to Squawkbox, I believe it was.
It was.
Left-wing agitprop kind of website, like the Canary, but worse, actually.
Well, they can't spell squawk for a start, which is a denigration of journalistic standards.
But yeah, they Squawkbox did an interview with Laura Pidcock, MP, and I don't know exactly how it came up, but one of the things that emerged was that she said she didn't want to be friends with Conservative MPs because she didn't want to get all cosy with them and treat it like a parlour club or a parlour or something like that, which, you know, the not treating politics like a game, not treating it like it's a gentleman's club and kind of all guffawing, and that is fine. But when you say you don't want to be friends with the Tory MPs, that just reeks really of being completely up your own arse. And it's just absolutely daft, because most people in the real world have friends who they disagree with politically. Being a Tory does not make you a bad person, just in the same way as voting Labour doesn't make you a good person. You know, there are some absolute arseholes and sexist, racist, misogynists in the Labour Party, and who vote and support Labour. There are those people also in the Conservative Party. In the Conservatives, you also have people who will go out of their way to stand up for women's rights, stand up for LGBT rights, and will actually, you know, stand up for just generally Britain and the working class as well. Now, you may disagree with them about the best ways to grow the economy, you may disagree with them about the roles of regulation, but the vast majority of Tories in this country, both supporters and party members, do want what's best for the nation. And
controversial words there from Steve Haynes.
No, it's absolutely appalling, isn't it? But the fact that you have someone who's clearly garnering a bit of a following in Labour, in the form of Laura Pidcock, coming out with these kind of statements is just absolutely appalling. To me, it's absolutely disgusting that someone can come out and effectively say, oh, yeah, no, these people are the enemy. No, you can't call Tories the enemy, because if you utilise the word enemy for them, what do you describe the Nazis that turn up in Charlottesville?
I think we call them very fine people, Steve, and we have the President of the United States. Sorry, we're doing it already.
But you get what I mean, though. It's like, these people, yes, you might disagree with them. Politically, they are your opposition. They are on the other side. But that doesn't make them the enemy. Hmm. The enemy are people that you are prepared to, you know, go all out against. And there's a difference between going all out against for the Tories than there is, than the BNP or the EDL or those, or what potentially UKIP could turn into if it elects their Islamophobic leadership candidate.
Well, quite. It's a very multi-layered question, I think, of how you go around opposing Tories and how, as a Labour Party, we go about trying to build alliances and form a government. Part of that, obviously, does involve talking to Tory voters and talking to Tories and trying to win them over to our side. It's going to be quite hard to do that if you don't know any of them yourself and don't quite know how they're thinking, which is one thing. I think Laura Pidcock has a point if she says that she doesn't want to be part of a kind of clubby gentleman's club in the House of Commons. I mean, Tom Harris, the former Labour MP, wrote an article for The Telegraph saying, well, if you haven't seen John Whittingate Dale sing Smoke on the Water in a very cut-glass English accent, what's the point of being an MP? Which felt like it was kind of proving her point, really. Yeah. On the other hand, then, you also have people who were jumping to Laura Pidcock's defence saying, oh, but it's fine, it worked for Dennis Skinner. Because, of course, in his 47 years in the House of Commons, Dennis Skinner has achieved... Exactly. So,
I don't know, he gave some good advice to Tony Blair on public speaking. There was a wonderful thread, actually, which came up on Twitter, which was in response to all of this, which was basically, here is a list of all of the things that happened because a Tory and a Labour person, I think there was a couple of like Liberals from way back in the day when the Liberals were one of the big two parties, and a Tory worked together. And you had things in there like the decriminalisation of being gay. You had the end of slavery as an actual kind of legitimate form of trade. So there were an awful lot of things in there which every last person in this country would look at and go, those are good things. And they happened because, you know, two people on different sides worked together.
If Michael Foot and Enoch Powell could make common cause on an issue,
yep,
which I think it was on a campaign in Kenya, I think.
Yep, this was exactly one of the things that was listed on this in that thread as well.
Then we can make common cause as well. Over Brexit. That's another podcast. I mean, that's why also there's a Labour at the moment that is still in campaigning mode. Momentum and Owen Jones are doing campaigning in a lot of Tory-held marginals, which is great.
Yeah.
I've got no problem with it. They're trying to unseat people like Ian Duncan Smith, people like Justin Greening,
Boris Johnson,
people like Boris Johnson,
Anna
which is
Salisbury's
great.
In there as well.
That's the thing, is that one of them is Anna Salisbury. Now, Anna Salisbury is quite a centrist, very Remainer, wet Tory. Granted, she has a very small majority. Granted, it's possible that it's a seat we can take. However, I would not want to throw all of my resources trying to unseat people like Anna Salisbury, because Anna Salisbury is one of those Tory MPs we can make common cause with. It's about where you target your resources. Obviously, a Labour MP for there would be absolutely great. But if we're going to be targeting our resources now, in the long campaign before a general, maybe we can find other people to target. And we should be trying to make common cause with her, short term, trying to save our country from a disastrous hard Brexit, than we should be trying to do a lot of door knocking.
Yeah, and the reality is also that a number of the areas, like it's Owen Jones who's organising a lot of these events, and that's absolutely fine. I think actually what he's doing here is actually a really good politics, getting people out there, getting people engaged, so that they're doing it now, so that when it comes time when it actually really does matter and the crunch time hits, they're already used to it.
Yeah, and
so it's really, really good.
And trying to utilise that big Labour membership as well.
I think, and I think a number of the ones that he's going after, like Ian Duncan Smith and Boris Johnson, with their kind of like their majorities of like around about 5,000 or 6,000, those make sense, because actually, yeah, Labour may be within a chance at taking them, but they will require a lot of work potentially to do it. You could easily see someone like Boris Johnson or Ian Duncan Smith hanging on by the skin of their teeth, whilst someone like Anna Sowerbury, to be honest, if you're going to take Uxbridge with Boris Johnson, you're going to take Sowerbury's seat as well, in all likelihood, given the size of the majorities, the sorts of swings you'd be looking at would take that over naturally without too much extra work and effort. So I think in terms of that, yeah, I think there probably are better areas and better to be working necessarily than, say, Anna Sowerbury's seat. And that's got nothing to do with just, you know, working together, although not targeting that area gives you a bit more leverage on her to then say, look, we're not even hitting you. We could be, but we're not. So give us a bit of assistance on this where we are in agreement. You know, there are lots of ways you can do that. It doesn't need to be an official kind of pact. Doesn't need to be, you don't even need to have a conversation with her about it, because this is politics. People look at these things and they know what's going on.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. We post a few things there. Please like it. Please subscribe to us and spread the word if you can. That would be great. We've hit 10,000 downloads now, which is amazing. So 10,000 Nottingham Champagne fans, can't be wrong. Do, if you have not already, this Bangor holiday, read A Very British Coup by Chris Mullin. We'll be discussing that in our inaugural book club episode very soon. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
Happy plotting.